Victoria, my wish, and Heidi, my wish is to present some material over the next 2 to 3 weeks that I'd like it very much to be a combination of presenting some material and then dialoguing together about it. So I really want to encourage informality. I've got lots of material to cover for sure, but I'd much prefer for it to be interactive. And so I'm far more committed to the interaction than I am to plowing through reams of material. There's plenty of material, and what we don't get to on this particular in this particular series of 2 or 3 sessions, we'll come back to it. So that's kind of the spirit of it. If I can kind of set that stage. And then secondly, I want to kind of place it in terms of the Wilbur's Aukwil map. I'm really looking primarily, starting today, at the lower left-hand quadrant. And he talks about that as being the collective interior in places. Other places he refers to it as being plural as opposed to singular. And we are looking at the interior, particularly of relationships. In that lower left-hand quadrant, he also addresses culture from the perspective of cultural anthropology, particularly, which tries to look at things from the inside as opposed to sociology, which typically observes things more from the outside, looks at demographics and statistics. So today will be a decidedly non-statistical presentation, and going to be focusing primarily on addiction and recovery as it's hosted and processed through the lower left-hand quadrant. So does that make sense so far in terms of kind of laying the groundwork?
Yes, it does.
Okay. I'll give you a little bit of a more personal kind of a backdrop to this, Victoria, and I want to encourage you as much as you feel comfortable to disclose along the way, too. I've been in recovery myself for about, it's been about 7 years. It started off with kind of approaching things from a harm reduction perspective, and then a little over 3 years ago moved into abstinence model of really dealing with recovery from alcohol and from prescription medications. And so I feel relatively young in this in terms of my own process. And ironically, maybe not surprisingly, I've worked in and around recovery from addiction in a very focused way for about a dozen years, actually for about 14 years. It's about 2000, I started working in the rehabs out here in California. And before that, had worked in clinical work, working with individuals and couples where one statistic from the National Institute for Drug Abuse states that one out of two clients coming to see a therapist is clinically addicted to alcohol or drugs. And that doesn't mean that people come in saying that they're addicted. They come in saying they're unhappy in their marriage or their work is a problem for them, or they have a parenting conflict, or that they're anxious and so on. But close to one out of two coming in are also addicted to some substance. And that's just the substances. That doesn't address any of the behavioral addictions. So that really matches my experience. And so it feels like I've worked for my entire career. I've been in psychology for about 35 years now, a good number of my clients, and let's just say for the sake of whatever, before I worked specifically in drug abuse and substance abuse and recovery, that many of my clients were dealing with addiction, including couples. And so I had this professional background, and then in mid-age, my middle years, I myself began to struggle with addiction and had to address that. So the material that I want to work here in this lower left-hand quadrant is some combination of a lot of years of observation and kind of fumbling around truthfully, and then addressing my own recovery and still very committed to it in the context of a relationship. My partner Colleen is a marriage and family therapist, and has survived this process with me, which is incredible. Certainly a central grace in my life, and we've done a lot of reflection over the years as we've gotten a little bit more toehold on my own recovery. that recovery really is best understood as being something more than just an individual, the addict goes and gets help process. And hence, in the last year or so, we've been developing material and begun to present, and are very active this year in presenting material where the title that we're using for the work we're doing is Plural Recovery. It's very indebted to Wilbur's writings about the lower left-hand quadrant, and is very much informed by an integral perspective. And what we're looking at is a model that takes seriously both the addict and his or her significant other and family, and a model that in the spirit of John and Guy's work in Integral Recovery, a model that perhaps is further reaching than the traditional AA and Al-Anon model. I've worked in the 12-step program personally and have high value for it. Colleen has worked in the Al-Anon, that side of the fence, for years herself prior to my knowing her and our relationship. In her previous marriage, she worked the Al-Anon program, and felt like there's a lot of resources there, but there's some limitations that might be helpfully expanded upon. And I think the integral perspective really offers us a map that can be embracing of the best of the 12-step programs, AA, NA, et cetera, as well as CODA and Al-Anon and all these resources. It provides more, especially, I think, for both Colleen and I, coming from the mental health disciplines, there's so much that's evolved over the last decade, that there's no way that the early roots of AA with Bill W. and Dr. Bob, there's no way that they had access to information that we now have about biology, including interpersonal neurobiology, as well as attachment theory and how that's evolved into affecting the approaches to therapy that are now available. So,
Bob,
so I want to...
Right, yes? It's Heidi, and Rona's with us. Welcome, Rona.
Hi. Sorry, I struggled to get in from the side, but thanks.
That's fine. We're glad to have you.
This is Welcome. Rona?
Yeah.
Hello, Rona. It's Bob here. Very nice to have you join us from South Africa, right? Are you in South Africa?
Yes. Hi.
Okay. Well, it's great to have you here, Rona. And Victoria is here with Heidi and me, so it's the four of us today.
Hi, Rona.
Hi.
Yeah. Rona, I was just introducing to Victoria and Heidi kind of the theme for the next this series, which will be the next 2 to 3 weeks. I actually think it'll be 3 weeks, and I haven't okayed that with the boss here, Heidi, but I think it's going to be a 3-week series if I've got your permission, Heidi, and blessings from the team here. And what we're addressing over the next 3 weeks, Rona, is Wilbur's lower left-hand quadrant, specifically the relational dimension underlying recovery from addiction. And so we'll be looking at what I'm calling plural recovery.
Okay.
And to clarify terms, you came in just as I was finishing a little piece that plural recovery certainly would be embracing of the best of what is available already in the 12-step programs in and around recovery through the 12 steps for those who are actively recovering from addiction, for example, in Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous and so on, along with its companion piece, which is Al-Anon and Alateen and CODA, other organizations that help support the non-addicted significant other manage what's going on in terms of the, typically it's a relationship crisis as well as an individual turning point. And while these resources seem helpful and have kind of a proven track record, there's so much expansion in the last, particularly I'd be pointing towards the last decade in terms of delivery of mental health services, introducing basically entire new disciplines into the conversation, that it makes sense that we update and expand upon what's been available up to this point. And this is very much in the heart of what we're about here at the Integral Recovery Institute, is integrating new advances, new innovations that can hopefully embrace the best of the 12-step traditions, which dominate, as you well know, dominate in treatment of recovery, but also to really add significant strides forward from other disciplines, particularly psychology and neuroscience, that it just makes sense that we keep updating the best that we have. So I'm going to be speaking into this over the next few weeks, and as we go through this, I'll offer more organization for each kind of lecture/dialogue. And that brings me to an earlier point I made to Rona, which is I really would encourage our dialogue. This is really meant to be a conversation. I have new material to present, much of which will be familiar, at least in terms of common sense, but I do want to ground this in some of the recent writings and recent research that's coming out of the fields of psychology and addiction recovery. But I'd love to have a dialogue. So can you hear me okay? Does that register so far, Rona?
That sounds wonderful. Thank you. Yes, I can hear clearly. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, great. It's good to have you here. I tell you how I'd like to introduce just the earliest part of our conversation today. And Heidi, if you have a moment to take this in, I would love your contributions along with Victoria and Rona. I wanted let me just say this as a preface. My partner, Colleen, Rona, I introduced my partner earlier. Colleen is a marriage and family therapist, and her work for the last many years has been, she focuses on working with couples. She works with couples that are in distress almost by definition. People generally don't come to see a therapist if they're in a happy place. And so Colleen works with highly distressed couples. Some large percentage of them are couples that are dealing with either active addiction or the aftermath of addiction, while one partner typically is moving into recovery from addiction and the other partner is in tatters. And we're going to be presenting in the next 2 months. We've got four presentations at universities, and one is at a major conference here that's actually being held in Los Angeles. It's called the Evolution of Addiction Treatment Conference, and there'll be people from all around the U.S. presenting at this conference. And we're really privileged to be invited to present a workshop at this conference on plural recovery. And our subtitle for the presentation is Evidence-Based Relapse Prevention for Couples. And so that gives you a sense of where Colleen and I have been traveling recently with this material. We're actually working on a book right now. The holidays provided us a chance to take a one-week retreat, and we did a lot of organizing, and we've done a lot of writing already, but we needed to organize it. So hopefully by the end of this year, we'll have a book in hand, and each of you will have a copy of it. But it'll be on this topic of plural recovery. And in that spirit, then, Colleen and I are presenting early in February at this local conference, as well as two times over the next couple of weeks at university settings. And we're going to open our presentation by presenting, we're actually going to enact a dialogue, a hypothetical dialogue or a vignette between a couple that are in the grips of this very circumstance. And I want to introduce the dialogue today. I can't enact it because it's just me here today. I want to introduce kind of the characters in this dialogue as being kind of not atypical characters in a situation like this. And then I want us together just to reflect on what might be possible issues that arise out of the situation. So if you'll just kind of sit back for a minute, and I'll detail a really quick introductory bio of this couple. I'll be talking later about Gary Nixon's approach to recovery, which he breaks into three stages, the first stage of which focuses on getting sober. And the second stage is about delving into healing relationships. This is a couple that's really in stage one, so they're early in recovery. And for the sake of our vignette, let's call them John and Susan. They're a heterosexual couple, and they've been together for 8 years. They have no children. John is, they're both professionals. John is an attorney, and Susan is a sociology professor. And just for you to know, this is very typical of Colleen's work, which is specifically working with couples at two different treatment centers here in the Los Angeles area. And this would be a very typical, it's not really due to any one couple, but it's a very typical scenario. So she has otherwise very high-functioning professionals. John's the attorney, Susan's a sociology professor, and they've come to see, let's say Colleen, they've come to see Colleen. John is 3 months sober, he's out of detox. He went into the hospital purportedly to address his heavy drinking. What's behind the scenes is that he went into the hospital to address his alcoholism, but he never told his wife, he never told Susan about the fact that he had also been taking benzodiazepines for some period of time to help manage his stress at work. He's in a very high-pressure corporate law environment in downtown Los Angeles, and they work 7 days a week oftentimes, and he's really stressed out. And so his drinking, he added to that, they drank socially, primarily over the years, but he added benzodiazepines to manage his stress. He never told his wife about that until he got out of the hospital, and I'll mention more about that in a minute. The process was is that he developed an increasing tolerance to the anxiolytics, to the benzos. Let's say that he was taking Xanax. I remember hearing one psychiatrist say that when you take one Xanax, that you need to take twice. The tolerance is so rapid with Xanax, as an example of the benzos. If you take one of them, the next one you need to take twice as much to achieve the same effect just by having taken one. So it's a complete upward slope, a steep slope of addiction to the benzos. They're highly addictive. And they're prescribed kind of willy-nilly by psychiatrists and physicians who, unfortunately, typically don't have much awareness about that. So he, like many people, took these with doctor's prescription, developed an increased tolerance to the benzos, and realized that they were getting out of control. What was happening is he was running out of the prescription before the end of the month, and so he tried to stop the benzos, and his anxiety now was so escalated because now he has the withdrawal symptoms of the rebound effect with the benzos, which led to his having to drink more. And for the longest time, for several months, he lied about this. He would tell his wife he was staying late after work again when, in fact, he was drinking. And he'd say that he was going out with his colleagues at the law office. He was actually going out to the bar alone and just drinking as much as he could to try to reduce his anxiety before he got home. He also began to sneak alcohol around the house, so he was no longer drinking socially with his wife, but had stashes of alcohol that he was drinking, again, just to try to maintain himself. This led to a crisis in the relationship where his wife finally caught on to it, and he went into detox. He got involved in AA in the rehab and came out of the rehab and continued with AA at least a couple times a week. And after about 3 months in the program, that's where he confessed to his wife that he had also been taking benzos for a good year earlier, and that was news to her. So now she's sitting with his revelation of not only having been sneaking alcohol and lying to her about that, about staying at work late and so on, but he's also now admitting to having been addicted to benzodiazepines for a good year prior to his going into the detox. So really when he went into detox, he was detoxing not just from alcohol, but from the anxiety medication as well. So that's the scenario, and what Colleen and I are going to do is we'll just do a brief enactment of it when we present this material at the conferences. But in lieu of that, do you all have any thoughts about what might be the impact of just what I've laid out so far, not only on John, who's the identified patient who's recovering from his addiction to both alcohol and benzodiazepines, but also to Susan, his wife? What might be the impact, and what might be the impact of that relational collision on John's recovery? And I really want to open it up now to Rona. You, any thoughts you have, Victoria, Heidi, would really love to hear from you.
I think one thing I would, Rona, sorry, sorry. Okay. Thing I would think is the guilt could play a huge role.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure. In fact, he was, in terms of how we've developed this vignette, he has tremendous guilt, and it was building for him in going to the meetings, the AA meetings, post-rehab. He was realizing that, if anything, the AA program is about ruthless honesty, and he felt like he'd been ruthlessly deceitful. And so there's a tremendous amount of guilt. And now his wife is really angry at him for having lied to him twice over, not only about the alcohol, but now about the benzos. And so, yes, he feels horribly guilty. And so that makes a lot of sense. Any other thoughts?
This is Victoria, and I can see that the effect on Susan would be one of having been betrayed. They've been together 8 years and develop a certain level of trust and belief that there is a strong relationship, and now she discovers that it's not only the alcohol, but it's kind of coming out in layers, ever deeper layers. So a huge sense of betrayal and difficulty now in trusting him.
Yes, yeah. Really well articulated, Victoria. That's so spot on to me. Betrayal is really at the core of this, isn't it? Is that just as John is dealing probably in the program with you know, at some point he's going to be dealing with steps 4 and 5, looking at resentments that he's accrued and how that's affected his relationships, doing a moral inventory. Well, you know just as well that Susan has her entire experience as kind of a companion piece, kind of separate but equal, including her own resentments for sure, rooted in having had her trust betrayed at this level for sure. And it's much worse than she imagined, even when he went in the hospital and got out. At least there was some relief that they've kind of begun to tame the dragon, so to speak. And now he reveals to her 3 months later that there's this whole other line of deceit that really, in some couples, it's almost like it's the straw that breaks the camel's back. I can't take anymore, and it's worse, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an
mm-hmm.
example of that. So absolutely, it'd be a tremendous crisis for her. And I liked how you put it, Victoria, is that the very basis of the relationship, the very foundation, is shaken to the core here, because I thought I could trust you. I thought we could at least reestablish trust. I asked you if you told me everything, and you said you had, and in fact you lied to me. You hadn't told me everything. And so it's much more than just a behavior that he's talking about. It shakes the very foundation of the trust that's at the core of the relationship. And so for many couples, this kind of revelation, whether it's of other drugs involved in this case, or possibly an affair outside the marriage that might have been aided and abetted by substance, these kinds of revelations oftentimes spell doom for a couple if they can't get help. And even if they can get help, there's no guarantee they can work it through. It's what the attachment theorists, who've had such an impact on psychology in the recent decades, it's what they call a primal attachment injury. It cuts right to the core of the attachment between the two. Yeah. Yeah.
And I just,
Heidi, do you have any thoughts?
Sure. This is Heidi. It may be implicit in the whole thing about betrayal already, but so not only is the relationship shaken to the core in the present, but then it casts this huge shadow over their whole future. Like, how can we move forward in case this happens again? And So their current situation is totally shaken, and their future has this terrible shadow over it.
Yeah. Really appreciate you articulating that. And I would imagine that you were thinking of that too, Victoria, when you made your comments about betrayal. But I wasn't thinking of it right. I was thinking of it more in terms of the past. It's like, what does this say about our past? But you're absolutely right, Heidi. How can we move into the future when we don't have a foundation, an essential foundation of trust? How can I trust anything that you say, or how can I trust that your silence is not another a veil over further deceit. So it's really, really toxic, really to the very core of the relationship. You're right. Rona or Victoria, do you have any other thoughts about this before we move on? I'm really open to all of your input.
I'm not right at the moment. I'm enjoying your input at the moment.
Well, this is Heidi again. Well, and then there's the whole financial thing. If Susan can't rely any longer on John in case he just completely fails totally and drops out of, can't even do his work anymore. If he relapses and it all goes haywire, then she's off on her own. And then what do they do? Anyway, yeah. All those kind of concerns.
Yeah, really good point, Heidi. I appreciate you bringing that in. In fact, as you're talking about it, what comes to mind, and I hope that this communicates to you guys. I'm thinking of it just as we're talking. It's that the core of the relationship is in question now, and you could almost fan across Maslow's hierarchy of needs and look at how undermined or threatened each one of these are. And I'll quickly go through them in the spirit of what Heidi's introduced, is that at a basic survival level, is John gonna survive this addiction? Is he really sincere about his recovery, or is his recovery really kind of a last gasp attempt to comply, let's say, with maybe Susan's confrontations without his really taking it seriously? But can she really trust that he's going to maintain his recovery? And if he spirals out of control again with addiction, what does that mean about not only the survival of the relationship, but just physical survival, pragmatic survival, which goes to Maslow's second level, which is just security. Is there going to be a house over her head? Are they going to be able to sustain, to be viable as a couple financially, just practically speaking? And, of course, we've talked about the belongingness needs here. The whole relationship in terms of connection is severely under duress. Not only has it been under duress in terms of the effect of substance on the relationship, in terms of what that does to the brain and how that manifests in terms of emotional connectedness and compassion and empathy and truthfulness. But is there any future where that could be repaired in terms of the relationship? On top of this, just to continue, Susan no doubt is shaken in terms of she probably had respect for her husband, for John, for his accomplishments. After all, he was making good money. He was working in one of the most prestigious law firms in downtown Los Angeles, well-known and well-respected, and now he's out of favor. It's leaked out into the public. It's hard for it not to, that he's now in recovery. He's not hanging out with his law firm colleagues anymore because they're socializing, including at lunches, was associated with martinis and et cetera. And so it's obvious to people that their people at work are questioning him. Well, Susan's questioning him. Is this somebody that I can respect and have esteem for? And then finally, in terms of self-actualization, referring back to Maslow, Susan and John have been on a path of growth together, and Susan continues to value spiritual and psychological growth. She has aspiration of sharing that with a partner, and now she's with somebody that in her mind is lying to her, which is the opposite direction that she'd want to go. So is there any future in terms of their sharing what she thought they had shared up to now? She's questioning all of it, of course. And do they have a future in terms of growing psychologically, relationally, spiritually together or not? All of this is thrown up in the air. So you can imagine the existential crisis this is for Susan, right alongside of John going through his massive reversal of fortune. Yeah.
You know, Bob, this is Victoria. What occurs to me is that the incident that has happened here with John and Susan completely cuts through all of the denial. And
yeah.
That's just like tearing down a whole belief, illusion, a whole system way of being. All of a sudden, it's just shattered.
Yeah.
And they're left with looking at these pieces, and it's absolutely devastating.
Yes, yes, it is. It's really well put, really well put, Victoria. Yeah.
So there's the positivity of going through the whole treatment and recovery process, but there's also this side of it as well.
Yeah. And as informed by, current developments in attachment theory and psychology, I think all of us have some sense of this, just in terms of our own lives, but also the research bears this out, is that our senses of self are so bound to our significant relationships, starting with our relationship to our parents early on and our other family members, and then our social references, including, in adolescence, particularly the development of peer relationships, that is so connected to our sense of integrity, of being uniquely the individual that we are, and then into adulthood with significant relationships, including partnerships. That there's no way to separate out what's happened to John individually, no way to separate that out from both of their senses of what's real, what's trustable, what they can count on, who they are in terms of their identity. And you're absolutely right, Victoria. All of that has come crashing down. I had the image as you were speaking of a mirror that's fallen off the wall and it's broken into 1,000 different shards. And even with the best of intentions, moving into recovery and being dedicated to recovery, let's say that he's dedicated to his work at AA. Let's say that Susan goes to Al-Anon. You've got underneath this fragmentation of reality that is so immense that going to a meeting or two, or going to 7 meetings a week, or however you slice it, it's like it feels right to stop and really address the primal wound that we're talking about to the very core of the relationship. And I think that this is a typical scenario. I don't imagine you disagree with me. It's a typical scenario when someone finally breaks through the denial. You'd want to say, well, isn't that good news? Well, it's kind of good news, bad mm-hmm. news. You can't work on it if there's not a breaking through the denial. The breaking through, that's the bane of their existence as well. It's horrible. It's a horrible breakthrough. Yeah. One author talks about the difference, sometimes the difference between breakthrough and breakdown is a pretty fine line,
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Other thoughts here?
I think, as Rome was speaking, this confusion with all the issues you've just mentioned, that deep, deep confusion of, I love this person, but, there's death and life existing at the same time, and I think that's the most destructive part in this type of challenge. How far can I go before I can no longer for the wife?
Yes. You're probably aware, Rona, of the literature around trauma and stress. And I'm kind of referencing back to earlier studies of mine, but clearly the most trauma, the deepest trauma is incurred in the related relationships that are the most significantly attached, the most intimate relationships. And so if you experience trauma at the hands of a complete stranger, it's horrible. Without a doubt. But if you add to that, then your deepest trust being invested in this other person and the most profound and sustained intimacy with this person, and then that person, you experience trauma in the hands of that person, it's however many times more traumatic, subjectively traumatic. The stress that is incurred is off the charts. And that's really what we're talking about, not as an exception, but more as the rule in this kind of scenario where you have a couple where, in this case, one individual from the couple is moving through denial, moving towards recovery, and also the relationship sustains an injury that, frankly, for many couples cannot be healed. I remember my first course in graduate school many years ago was on, the whole course was on divorce, and it's interesting, the professor that taught the course was from South Africa. I just remembered that. It's interesting, as my daughter used to say when she was little, that's an interesting coinkadink. and I remember he was a very seasoned a psychotherapist. His background was in social work. And he talked, and I've never forgotten this, and it's been borne out not only in my clinical work, but in my own personal experience, having been married and then divorced, is that there's a point of no return in a marriage. And once someone crosses that, and typically it's one partner does before the other, once somebody crosses that, in effect, there's no getting back. You can't put the jack back in the box. And while oftentimes it's impossible to know that, when you're in the relationship, it's impossible to know. You feel like you've lost your fight. You've lost your oomph for the relationship. Oftentimes it's only in retrospect that you realize, you know, after that point, I was never able to get back caring about the relationship enough to work on it. And this professor, Dr. Silling, talked about this to us, and he said oftentimes the therapist or the facilitator will see it first, that, to put it in psychoanalytic terms, one partner has decaffected, has given away their care or concern or their investment in the relationship, and the therapist can oftentimes see it before the actual individuals in the couple. And so you have couples coming in not infrequently, if they do come in on the heels of addiction and moving into recovery, which that's a whole other issue because many don't see it soon enough to come in, soon enough to address it. You get couples coming in, and my partner Colleen works with these couples day in and day out, that they're right on the brink. If not already into the point of no return, they're on the brink of that. And that'll be part of what we'll be addressing over the next couple of weeks, is what to do to begin to do the excavation work to get to the roots of what we've just been talking about. Because if this isn't addressed, if this kind of rupture, this essential rupture, isn't repaired, the relationship is doomed, and there's no doubt about that. And plenty of relationships fall apart right on this point. And then sadly, I'll add this at this point, sadly, when the relationship begins to unravel, already it's been undermined by the betrayals that Victoria was talking about, and you too, Heidi, is that the addict who's in recovery, the number one trigger for relapse for addicts in recovery, the number one trigger is stress. And by far the number one stressor for most all of us is relationship stressor, because we're wired for relationships, so says attachment theory. And so you can imagine, you can see the dominoes falling here. The relationship begins to falter. Now there's mistrust. There's no longer stability in the relationship. It's in a state of crisis. The addict himself or herself is trying to recover from the addiction, trying to sustain a program of abstinence, and they're enduring a level of stress that they've never known in the relationship. As Victoria just put it, it's all broken into bits. And so the probability of relapse is so increased by virtue of what we're talking about. And so if we don't address this, if we have no means of addressing it, there's little hope for the addict to really sustain his or her recovery. Does that logic make sense to you all?
Makes a lot of sense.
Yes, definitely.
Could I make one more comment as you were talking?
Please, about... I invite it, please.
Drona again, I was thinking of an article I read last year where they were looking at the high suicide risk. Because apparently in statistics, I don't know if you've seen similar stats, but in 2010, the suicide rate all over the world was higher than death by natural disasters, war combined. I think there was another article. And in the article, they found one of the reasons to be, firstly, the disconnect from self, and then the disconnect from others, and the disconnect from Earth. And I was just thinking now why I was thinking of this in your discussion, is that, you know, that disconnect from self in addiction for both partners becomes so huge that Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to work on a relationship, to connect with each other while they're still trying to connect with themselves due to the trauma they've been through.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, thank you, Rona. That statistic is very bracing, isn't it? That if I understood you right, that the suicide rate worldwide is higher than the combination of the fatalities owing to war and natural disaster. Did I get that right?
That's correct. I'll try and find the article sometime. And
I'd love it. If you'll send it to Heidi or send it to me, you've got my email address. We can disperse that to the others. It's really telling. And I love how you broke that down in terms of disconnection from self, disconnection from other, and disconnection from the earth. Did I understand that right?
Correct. Yeah. They associated. That's why they see a lot of the eco-sustainability and the death of the earth linked to a actually a cause of disconnect from self initially.
I really appreciate that. Somebody else wanted to comment?
Well, I have, Rana, a point of clarification. So the suicide rate, I couldn't quite hear you. The suicide rate from what specifically is the highest?
Just suicide rate compared to fatalities due to war or natural disasters. Statistics of suicide, the number of individuals dying from suicide is higher than dying from war or natural disasters.
Yeah, very, very powerful statistic. I want to tie in what you've just shared with us, Rona, into a kind of a context for this conversation, and then we'll wrap up for today. And next week, what I would like to do would be to come back and explore what Gary Nixon talks about in his recent articles and books. He talks about stage one recovery, in which the individual who's been addicted is attempting to get sober, and I want to talk about it in a relational context, that addicted individual's recovery is so impacted in the way that we're just talking about right now, including with the statistics Rona shared, is so impacted by the disconnect from their significant other, owing to the significant other oftentimes being overwhelmed and, to put it in psychological terms, burnt out. And I'll talk about stress theory and what burnout really looks like psychologically as well as biologically next week. And then we'll go deeper into what can be done in early recovery to address this, as well as what are some really profound limitations in early recovery, just in terms of the brain's capacity, the addict's brain's capacity to be able to move into deep level repair work, let's say, for the couple. It's really hamstrung by that brain not being, at least early on in the recovery, that brain is really limited in its capacity for empathy, for compassion, for self-reflection. So we'll talk about both some, I think, some positive ideas about what might be done for both partners, including 12-step work, but beyond that. And I'll talk more specifically about that, but also really acknowledge in what Nixon calls stage one recovery, that there's some very profound limitations that if they're not taken into account, you're building in a high probability of frustration and people giving up because it's just not working, you know, in terms of the couple. So we're going to talk about kind of a graded hierarchy of intervention, starting with the earliest stages. And so that's kind of where we're headed. But I wanted to wrap back just for a moment as we wind up here with what Rona was saying. Rona, I love how you articulated that in terms of the various disconnects. And I think what it does is it gives us a living picture of the value of Ken Wilber's quadrant model, just to look at the quadrants for just a moment, is that you can see here how the upper left-hand quadrant, which is the individual interior, and let's say if we use the terms that you were just using, Rona, that my disconnection from myself is primary in both my addiction process but also my recovery process. And how do you heal or bridge that disconnection from self? That would be primarily upper left-hand quadrant, according to the AQUIL model. we've been addressing, and I'll continue to address, the lower left-hand quadrant, which is the collective interior, and in this case, the relational interior, what's going on inside the relationship in and around recovery. And that would relate to disconnection from other. And depending on where you land in any particular quadrant, you could just as easily argue that that's primary, that the foundation of the relationship has been shaken to the core. Victoria gave us a very kind of graphic illustration of what that looks like in terms of the breakage, in terms of the fallout. And that with that as the context for recovery, the recovery is highly at risk, highly jeopardized by that reality. And so that lower left-hand quadrant is at least as important if you take that standpoint as the upper left-hand quadrant. And then if we add to it disconnection from the earth, which in my view, I don't want to reduce that to any one quadrant. It's probably affected across all quadrants, but we might also look at this a la Wilbur at the lower right-hand quadrant, which is the collective exterior. The way that we relate to institutions, the way that we relate to the world is radically affected. The way we relate to the earth is radically affected by this whole process as of addiction and recovery. Excuse me for just one second.
Come on in.
I just had somebody join me. That you can't exclude any one of those perspectives, disconnection from self, disconnection from other, disconnection from the earth, and in fact, they're all coextensive, they're all related, and I think this is the spirit, as I see it, of not only Ken Wilber's writings, but what John has written in Integral Recovery, and what we're about here, is that there's a cross-informing across these various quadrants, and that you separate them out only for the purposes of exploring them, but that in reality we're integrated human beings that have a sense of self that's intimately related to our connection to our intimate others, and that both of those aspects are intimately connected to how we treat our environment, that it's all wound together. And that really is the idea of a single integer. A single indivisible integer that's at the heart of integral theory, it seems like to me. And so here we are. We'll be talking about plural recovery, about the lower left-hand quadrant, and how that impacts every other quadrant for sure. I'll finish with this. I remember seeing a psychoanalyst myself back in the 1980s. I was in graduate school. And I remember her making this statement one time in one of our therapy sessions, is she believed that if people in power could work on their relationships, and in fact, I'll be more specific, she actually expanded beyond and say that if women could be placed in positions of power in the world as opposed to males, with the assumption that women possibly have more access to their emotions and possibly would be more inclined to work on family relationships, she believed that war would disappear. And whether or not that's accurate, you can see what she was pointing towards, is that in essence, if there could be more attention given to the foundations of self-identity and emotional life, if there could be more attention given to relational integrity and connectedness, that what we do to one another on the planet, and in fact what we do to the planet, would be radically affected in a positive way. I'm gonna finish what I say here. I want to allow for a couple minutes of dialogue or response, and then we'll wind up for today.
Right. There was something I was thinking of now, but I'll get the thought back for it's Rona. I just lost the thought. I'll get it back just now again, hopefully.
I didn't understand the last part, Rona. Could you repeat it? I'm sorry. I couldn't quite make it out.
I've got the thought back. I was just thinking of, there was a book recently written, I'll get the author and the name through, bringing all this together again in terms of, I think, a lot of things you just said now with us being caught up in a patriarchal society. A lot of the addiction and other issues, other you know, trauma issues related to a patriarchal society. And that's where they also brought back the whole link with the earth and connecting to the more female intuitive side at a deep healing level. And I think a lot of what you said now has to do with that, you know, in terms of women in power. It's more about bringing the intuitive right brain side back into balance.
Yes, yes. You know, you're reminding me, and I've actually ordered this book, and I was looking as you were talking. I've ordered this book, and it's been recommended by your friend and colleague, our friend, Guy. It's a book that he's recommended to me, and I can't remember the title of it. I've just ordered it in the last this weekend. That is at least one resource that addresses this, and so it's on both of us, Rona, to remember the names of these books and then to share them. There's a book that Guy has recommended.
Okay.
A resource that addresses it really addresses the social and cultural backdrop for addiction. And Heidi, maybe you remember it. It's one that Guy's mentioned. I have it on order, and I can't track down my order right now online. I'm not coordinated enough to do that.
I don't know which one that is, but I would love to find out.
Yeah. If Guy were here, he'd nail it in a second. And it might be the same one, or it might be a companion piece to what Rona's thinking of. As we wrap up, Victoria and Heidi, do you have any final thoughts for today?
Well, I just find this very valuable to look at this whole thing from a relational perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, it just takes, I remember when we just began to realize that there were effects on the family of all of this, and to be able to take it to this deep relational level is invaluable.
Yeah.
And I can begin to see the implications for a much broader spectrum of recovery when this is the case.
Yes, yes. Thank you. Thank you for your affirmation. I appreciate it and feel it very deeply. That this focus of the next few weeks on the lower left-hand quadrant, specifically around family relationships in and around addiction and how that affects our sense of self, back to Rona's earlier point, as well as possibly has ramifications for then how we deal in our world politically and economically and environmentally. I feel like there's a really rich conversation here. It's what delights me about our community here that's developing at Integral Recovery. I absolutely love these conversations, and I've hungered for them over the years of my own recovery as well, and I'm really grateful for this opportunity for the dialogue. I want to thank all three of you for participating, and this is very much the spirit of how I like to host our conversation. So I'll have a bunch of notes. If you were sitting here with me, I'm sitting in my chair here with my computer on my lap, and all of these typed notes and what we've created here today takes a handful of these notes and amplifies them, and I feel like it'd be crazy to talk about relationship and not do it relationally. So I'm really grateful for the relationship, the connection. As a final asterisk, as a final postscript, I have discovered the name of the book that I ordered, and it may or may not be the book you were thinking of, Rona, but I'd like to mention it to all of us here, and we can check it out on our own. Guy has touted this book for the last year of our friendship, and I finally ordered it online. I couldn't find it. It's at a steep price. That was the impediment for me. I couldn't find it any kind of bargain, and so I finally just ordered it for myself as a Christmas gift. And the title of the book is The Globalization of Addiction. The Globalization of Addiction. Which wouldn't give you the in. The title doesn't point to what Guy has talked about with me. And if you're interested, I'd encourage you to look it up and find the description of it, because it really looks at least some of the issues that Rona's raised and that I'm sure that all of us have asked questions. And here's somebody who looks at addiction from a less of an individualistic perspective and less of a psychological perspective, but more of a social, political, cultural, environmental perspective. The author, by the way, is a Canadian psychologist by the name of Bruce Alexander. And it comes highly recommended by our colleague, Guy. So, Bruce Alexander, The Globalization of Addiction. And I'll be getting it here in the next week or two and begin working my way through it. So hopefully we can continue. And Rona, if you think of resources, send them out to us. Please do, and we'll disperse them like I mentioned.
Thank you.
Really delighted for our stepping into the pool today together. And we'll continue swimming a little bit deeper next week if that's okay with everybody, okay?
Thank you so much.
Great. Look forward to it. Thank you,
yeah,
Bob.
Thank you. All right. You're very welcome. Blessings to all. Have a very good week, and we'll see you next week.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.